This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. This week, Attorney General William Barr testified in one House of Congress. He spoke to the Senate Judiciary Committee, defending his handling of the release of the Mueller report and the public statements he made during the nearly month-long period when he had seen the report, but the public had not. Barr released his first letter, the one in which he said the report did not establish collusion or coordination between the Trump campaign and the Russians, on March 24. In a March 27 letter, Robert Mueller wrote to Barr complaining that his letter, quote, did not fully capture the context, nature, and substance of this office's work and conclusions, unquote. Mueller urged Barr to clear up public confusion by promptly releasing Mueller's own executive summaries. Barr did not do that right away, but he did release the full redacted report approximately 3 weeks later. Democratic senators were dissatisfied with Barr's explanations of his choices about what to say and when, and I think were a little put off by Barr's characterization of Mueller's letter as a bit snitty in his suggestion that it must have been some staff guy who wrote that. And then Barr declined to appear on Thursday before the House Judiciary Committee in a dispute over the manner in which he would be questioned and as part of a broader effort by the administration to deny requests for appearances and such by administration officials before the Democratic House. Today we're going to talk, among other things, about the calls from Democrats for Barr to resign. Now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center, and I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post. Hello.
Hey, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
Rich, what has been your takeaway from this week's Barr news?
Well, I think the whole Barr thing is kind of a misdirection. Mueller, if he wanted to recommend that Trump be charged for a crime for alleged obstruction, he could. If Democrats want to reach a different conclusion than Barr did on the law, they can. They can impeach the president. And the obsession with the letter summarizing the findings, I just don't get, because you point out he released the report in its entirety, almost entirely unredacted, so everyone could draw their own conclusions. And I think this is just a bizarre obsession among many having to do with the Russia investigation. But he didn't lie to Congress. He was terse and precise in all of his answers, even the ones that are being pointed to as supposedly misleading. So I just don't get this one.
Liz, I think that there's a sense among some Democrats that impeachment is needed to express the idea that it's not okay to obstruct justice. And they're bothered by Barr's implication that Trump's behavior that's described in the second volume of this report was essentially okay, at least as a legal matter, that it can't be a crime to interfere with an investigation when you're president so long as you're only using your legal powers in order to do that. And so I think there's some interest in impeachment basically as an expressive thing to do what Rich is describing there. Democrats do have the option to reach a different conclusion on the law than Bill Barr did, and the way they would express that would be by impeaching him.
Yeah, well, certainly an impeachment proceedings have been begun for less in our history. But I think that the problem that Democrats are facing is they feel that they have several avenues through which they might explore impeachment. They might attempt to actually impeach Trump. They might try to impeach Barr. And I think that they believe that, and I think there's probably some reality to this, going for both or going for the lower hanging fruit or the less serious target might foil future plans. So there's some struggle inside the party about what exactly to do.
Rich, you've said on this show that you think the second volume of the Mueller report about obstruction of justice contains quite a few bad facts about the president. What do you think should be done about those? Is there any sort of accountability for his behavior that you favor?
Yeah, I mean, there's an election coming up, and people can take this on board and factor it into their decision who they're going to vote for in November 2020. But I think, you know, Barr, you know, he doesn't have as hostile interpretation of these facts and Trump's conduct as some other people, which is his right. But in his testimony, he was constantly making the point that he just didn't think there was enough evidence to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to a jury that he was guilty of this crime. And that's not, you know, a major exculpatory statement. It's just saying he can't be charged with a crime. And we've talked about this on the show before. There's just this weird dynamic. If you say he's not guilty of a crime, everyone thinks you're defending him. But it doesn't mean he didn't do things that were wrong. You know, asking people to lie and bullying people and come up with these crazy schemes was wrong. It's just not a crime. So not everything that's wrong is a crime. Not everything that's legal is right.
Liz, what have you been watching this week?
So this week we heard about or began to receive details about another mass shooting, this time in Poway, California, at a synagogue. It's It's not worth mentioning the name of the shooter, but I did pay attention to the manifesto, which I know is questionable, but as a member of the media, I feel a little bit obligated to read those documents when they come out. And as it turned out, this mass shooter was not only motivated by vicious online memery like the Christchurch shooter, but also by a form of Christian theology, which, as someone who has a schooling in Christian theology, struck me as badly warped, extremely destructive, and very disturbing. Nobody's really been calling on Christians to disclaim this guy. I think that's fair, even though when this happens with Islamic terrorists, people do usually call on Muslim communities, moderate Muslims, they'll say, to denounce the person, which strikes me as unfair. But I would like to denounce him anyway. I fully denounce him. And what occurred to me in reading his screed was that it's not only a failure of politics and acculturation, it's a failure of theology. He was badly catechized, as we might say. He had poor catechesis. He had a poor understanding of Christianity. He sees Christianity as a religion which ordains the existence of individual races and that doesn't permit any kind of mixing between races. I don't see anything like that in the Bible. Some of the most primitivist Calvinists in the country, such as the Westboro Baptist Church, for example, still support civil rights for people of different races. And many of them don't express any issue with racial intermixing because that doesn't strike them as being a sin. That's a very low baseline to start from, but I think it's a fair baseline. I think the other issue is this person clearly believed that Christianity permits a level of favoring one's neighbors and hating one's enemies that's clearly denounced by Jesus Christ. And there's something very disturbing to me in that in this particular political moment.
Rich, I think after the Christchurch massacre, there was a lot of worry for good reason about both retaliatory attacks and copycat attacks, that it could inspire people who shared similar extremist ideology to carry out their own attacks. And then after the anti-Christian attacks in Sri Lanka, you had the defense minister in that country claiming that the attacks there had been planned in retaliation for the attack in Christchurch, which I don't think we know that to be the case, but I do think it's something we have to worry about. And this feels like something that calls for cooling rhetoric from political leaders. There was an interesting sort of political kerfuffle in the U.S. over statements from Democrats about the Sri Lanka attack that seemed reluctant to use the phrase that it had been an anti-Christian attack. And I think part of the impulse there was basically to avoid feeding into this narrative of a Christian versus Muslim global struggle that can encourage attacks like this on both sides.
Well, what I'm most disturbed by is just the possible analogous dynamic we have here going to school shootings, where you had this horror in Columbine and it became an obsession of, you know, a violent fringe of people online. And then they would try to act it out on their own and repeat it. And then their act would become part of this iconography of mass shootings at schools, and on it went. And this guy who committed this act at the synagogue was inspired by the Christchurch shooting, was inspired by the Pittsburgh synagogue shooting. And it's notable that both the Christchurch shooter and this guy were active on this 8chan message board, where people encourage one another to not just spew venom online, but actually go out in the real world and do harm to people. So I'm just fearful that we'll just see a recurring copycat phenomenon here. With regard to his theology, I don't think it'd be recognizable to any mainstream Christian in this country. Liz is right. There haven't been great calls on Christians to denounce him, but actually the Presbyterian denomination that his family went to did denounce this act, and there's just nothing in his theology that is recognizably Christian or within shouting distance of the Christian mainstream.
Liz, how effective do you think denunciations like that are? I mean, I this is something I struggle with all the time with these sorts of fringe figures, that you have mainstream politicians and media figures and religious figures, but when you have these communities online that have basically chosen to separate from a lot of those establishment authority figures and communities, I wonder how, if there's an effective way to reach the sort of people who would, you know, post about these attacks on 8chan.
Yeah, it's a little despairing, right? I mean, because on one hand, you want to think, well, if this person was really what he says he was, which was a radicalized Christian, then you should be able to appeal to his interest and the interest of other people like him in understanding what the religion actually says about the kind of behavior he carried out. You know, Jesus says, if you're only good to those who are good to you, to your own kith and kin, how good are you? Anybody can do that. Christians have to be good to everybody, even their enemies. If someone strikes you, turn the other cheek, et cetera, et cetera. You would hope they would be interested in understanding the truth about the religion. On the other hand, I think that a lot of these guys, these shooters, they're not particularly ideologically committed to much of anything. Rather than being radicalized Christians, they're kind of Christianized radicals, right? They're people who got on 8chan, who were already looking for something to be furious and incensed about, and they find some sort of reason to carry out their violence, sort of like we see in ISIS fighters. None of them are experts in the actual religion. They have famously, some of these people buy guidebooks to Islam before they run off and join ISIS, right? And I think this is probably a similar case. But if there's anything that we can do as a Christian community to prevent future violence or ideation like this, I think we're still obligated to do it.
This week, I have been watching the first round of presidential polling since Joe Biden officially entered the race for the Democratic presidential nomination, and it looks very good for him. CNN has Biden at 39%, with Bernie Sanders far behind at 15%. Quinnipiac has Biden at 38% and Sanders at just 11%, which actually puts him in third place, a point behind Elizabeth Warren, who's at 12%. And, you know, when you look at these polls, people tend to say, well, it's early and early polls don't mean that much. And that's kind of what people said about Donald Trump for a long time, who just proceeded to lead the polls all the way through the contest in 2016. Most commonly, the person who leads the polls at the beginning ends up winning the nomination. And so, Liz, I'm wondering what you make of watching that. In particular, Sanders, you know, give or take, had about 40% of the support last time around in 2016. What does it say that he's polling so low right now? Other candidates can point to low name ID and say, well, I'm Kamala Harris and I'm known in California and I'm going to get my message out nationally over the next several months. Shouldn't Bernie Sanders already be a known quantity and already have more than 11 to 15% of the national support?
I think part of what you're seeing with the Biden announcement polling bump is that a lot of Democrats are very, very scarred by what happened in 2016. There's a huge amount of like political PTSD that came out of Clinton losing in that kind of stunning fashion. And even though we all look back now and say like, oh, it was inevitable. If you remember the actual election night, people were extraordinarily shocked. I think that part of that has led Democrats to a more conservative position where they feel like maybe Hillary Clinton was too radical, or it was too radical of a proposition to run a woman, and that's why she lost. And so they're reverting back to who's the most conservative Republican-esque Democrat we could possibly run. That way we can cut off this tail risk of losing voters because the candidate is too radical. So I suspect that has a lot to do with people being a little bit Bernie shy at this point. But I think, or I hope, as a partisan of the left, as you know, that a close review of Biden's record will show that these Democrats, it's not just that Biden isn't a radical candidate, it's that he's an extraordinarily conservative Democrat and not a good choice.
Rich, do you buy the idea that Biden is an extraordinarily conservative Democrat? Peter Suderman had an interesting piece for Reason this week, arguing essentially that his politics are similar to Walter Mondale or John Kerry, and that we would have thought of him as being a solidly, you know, a person who was solidly not in the centrist wing, in the more lefty wing of the Democratic Party 10 or 20 or 30 years ago, and that this reflects a shift in what's considered left.
Yeah, definitely. 2 or 3 years ago. I mean, no one has really thought of Biden as a moderate before. It's just that the left has far surpassed him to his left. And I think these poll numbers are notable. And as I've said in the show before, I kind of go back and forth on Biden, whether he's a Jeb or, you know, a real serious front runner who, you know, has a lock on the non-woke, non-Twitter element of the party, which is larger than many of us realize on a daily basis, given the voices that are most prominent. And these are really eye-popping numbers. So it is early, but they're front runner numbers. Bernie is now back with the rest of the pack of five or six people kind of bunched up. And then, you know, they're all the also rans and 1% and 0%. So I imagine there'll be it'll be a complicated road, and there'll be a lot of surprises to come. But the first week couldn't have gone better for Biden, because a lot of conventional wisdom was his first day is going to be his best day. And his first day wasn't his best day. He rose in the polls.
Liz, I think another thing that has driven a little bit of softening in Bernie Sanders' poll numbers is the uptick in Elizabeth Warren's poll numbers. The two of them have, you know, very different messaging about what I think are in a lot of ways similar policy platforms. And a few weeks ago, we'd been asking, you know, why is Warren's platform not connecting with more voters? It seems like maybe it is now, and maybe it's drawing away some people who otherwise would have supported Sanders.
Yeah, I think that's possible. I think there's going to be a split there until one of them drops out, and then they can unify the progressive base. You know, from my point of view, still a preference for Sanders over Warren. I've been very heartened by her policies. She's been submitting policies pretty regularly that are very well thought out and interesting. At the same time, I still just have my doubts about some of them. One of the recent policies she suggested would attempt to lower maternal mortality rates by withholding monies from hospitals that had bad records on maternal mortality. But this would mean withholding money from hospitals that are really struggling, often hospitals in poor areas that serve poor people. That kind of incentivizing and disincentivizing that doesn't really fit with a single payer model as I conceive of it is a little bit disturbing to me. And I've seen some other instances in her policies that are sort of means tested in that way and seem like they could have some real downsides. And I see less of that on the Sanders side. So I'm still leaning towards Sanders, but wouldn't be disappointed by any means if it were Warren.
Let's take a quick break. I will be back with Ruth Lowry of National Review and Elizabeth Brunig of The Washington Post to talk about parenting. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
What do you think? Share your thoughts on today's show on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. And download the KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
If you're listening to our show, you're probably someone who appreciates all sides of an argument. So there's another podcast we think you should check out, Intelligence Squared US. America's leading debate series, they bring the most influential thinkers like David Brooks, Arianna Huffington, and Deepak Chopra together to debate contentious topics like free speech, the environment, and religion. It's not about soundbites and pundits, but a thoughtful, spirited competition of ideas. Find Intelligence Squared US wherever you get your podcasts. Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The Washington Post. And we are now joined by Emily Oster. Emily is an economist, and she teaches at Brown University. Emily is also the author of a new book called Crib Sheet, a data-driven guide to better, more relaxed parenting from birth to preschool. In this book, Emily takes a data-driven look at popular advice for raising young children, looking at what's actually proven to be useful and what's not. The reason we're discussing a parenting advice book on a show about politics is that parenting is a big issue in politics. Politicians debate how their policies will make it easier and more affordable to raise children who are given opportunities for success. And in particular, governments lately are dealing with public health effects that ensue when parents decide not to give their children recommended vaccinations. Hello, Emily.
Hi.
So first of all, congratulations on the book.
Thank you.
This is your second book in this general area, following up on your 2013 book, Expecting Better, on pregnancy. You're an economist. What made you decide to start writing parenting books?
So I got pregnant is the sort of short answer, and I did not find out there the parenting books that kind of were going to deliver on the approaches that I wanted to take to my pregnancy and parenting. And so having not found the books, I tried to write them myself.
I'm wondering, in the process of researching and writing this book, did you change any of your policy views? Did you discover something the government should be doing or shouldn't be doing to help parents with parenting?
I think there are certainly policies which seem like they're a very good idea, like mandatory vaccinations. But then there are other places where I think sometimes the kinds of statements we make about things like, should you co-sleep, some of those statements end up being more aggressive than the data warrants. And I think that that can lead to some backlash against some of these policies. So I think it's a sort of complicated area.
Liz, I know you've been a reader of Emily's first book.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. I think it was 2013 that was Expecting Better. I read that when I got pregnant in 2015. I just went ahead and got the epidural and ate food I wasn't supposed to eat, and now I have a three-year-old. Everything's fine.
That's great. Excellent.
So I think those examples get at something that's important in the book, which is that there are a number of cases where it seems like mothers are being encouraged to do something that is costly in terms of time or money or effort, that it's not clear that it actually produces real benefits for mother or for the child. And so it seems that at a societal level, like rectifying that could do a lot of good. In particular, there might be people who are deciding to have fewer fewer children, or that it is too difficult to have children, in part because through social recommendations, we've made parenting more difficult than it needs to be. Is there anything to be done about that besides, you know, I mean, just, you know, reading books like yours that help clear up some of those misconceptions?
I agree with you. I think that there are probably people who are like, you know, I can't have another one because I'm really have to invest in the ones that I have, and this is taking so much time. But I'm not sure that policy is going to be the way to address that, because the truth is that a lot of those pressures are social. They come from your parents or from your sort of other from your friends, from people you see around. So I think that if you ask people, you know, are you feeling pressured by the government to spend so much energy on parenting, I think that they would say no, but they do feel those pressures from, you know, non-governmental sources.
Rich, I know that there are a lot of figures on the right now who are focused on trying to find public policies that can encourage parenting and make parenting easier. When you look at that, what do you see as the role for government here versus the societal role?
Well, I think a lot of the conservative proposals are come from the framework that government already has a heavy hand here, and it tends to be biased towards single people, at least in a lot of its tax and entitlement policies. So you'd want to come up with family policies to tilt the balance back. But I have a question for Emily. You know, I think a lot of this kind of guilty parenting, right, it tends to be among people who have kind of the wherewithal to be worried about every single specific practice. But I'm just curious why there seem to be so many misconceptions, given how desperate people are for information and how they go searching to try to find what's the best in terms of sleep training and breastfeeding and all the rest of it. You'd think there would be a real accent on getting accurate information, but there still seems to be so many misconceptions out there.
Yeah, I think part of the issue is that the evidence on this stuff is, in many cases, very poor, and it is quite hard to sort through. So, you know, if you want to find a study that supports your view that sleep training is fine, you can find many of those. If you want to find a study that supports your view that sleep training is not fine, you can sort of also find some of those, or at least studies that have been interpreted like that. And I think that it is not straightforward for somebody to just go on the internet and learn what the whole literature about something says. But I think that even in a world in which everybody has access to all that information, they do not always have the ability to sort of sort through which of those pieces of information are right. So it's kind of easy to find information that supports either view. And then it's easy to find people who support either view. Some of them say that they have the best information. And I think that that has exacerbated some of these confusions.
For the benefit of listeners who are not parents, sleep training is when you essentially leave the child to cry it out at night to get used to sleeping without being comforted?
Yeah, making sure your kid is comfortable and so on, but then putting them in the bed and closing the door and having them fall asleep on their own. And it's called cry it out because they will typically cry, although they'll typically cry for, you know, a couple of days and then not after that.
Could you talk a little bit about the evidence on breastfeeding? Because it seemed to me from the book like we're making errors in both directions here, that you have mothers who would like to breastfeed but don't have the social support they would need in order to do that effectively. And then you have other mothers for whom that's difficult or very unpleasant, and they sort of face overstated claims about how important it is that they breastfeed.
Yeah, absolutely. I think you've hit it exactly on the head. So I think on the side of like what are the benefits to breastfeeding, you hear all kinds of sort of grandiose claims. And I think, you know, what the best evidence says is that there are some short-term benefits to the baby, particularly around digestion, and some maybe even longer-term benefits to the mom. But that some of these claims about long-term benefits for your kids, like IQ and obesity reductions, those are not supported in the best data. And I think that by overstating the case for the benefits of breastfeeding, people who can't or don't want to end up feeling really, really shamed. On the flip side, we make breastfeeding incredibly difficult in the U.S., both because of sort of social norms around, like, is it okay to do this in public, but also because people don't always have access to places to pump if they're going back to work because we have such a terrible set of maternity leave policies. So we're sort of simultaneously standing in front of people saying, this is the most important thing you can do for your baby. And if you don't do this, your kid will never be successful. And then saying, by the way, we're just going to make this incredibly difficult. But it's really important. But also, we're not going to help you at all. And I think that we could really use some policies which kind of did more help and less shaming.
Liz, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Family Fun Pack and sort of a set of, you know, a broader set of policies aimed at sort of shifting government benefits toward families with children, trying to equalize consumption between parents and non-parents.
So the Family Fun Pack is a 7-part policy proposal presented as a package by my husband, Matthew Brunig's think tank, the People's Policy Project, which is a crowd-funded socialist policy think tank. The Family Fun Pack, like I said, consists of 7 parts, and they're all aimed at reducing poverty and financial stressors on families. So there's a child allowance in there, just a monthly child benefit, free health care, included free school lunches, which shouldn't be that hard, free pre-K, which already exists for us in D.C., free child care or a stipend for parents who stay at home. It also includes a parental leave package, which is very extensive and includes dads, and then a baby box like they have in Finland, the famous baby boxes you can watch being unboxed on YouTube. The aim there is just to reduce the pressures that come with having kids, a lot of them that are a result of what Matt calls the mere addition problem, which is just adding a resource suck onto the family every time you have a kid, affectionately a resource suck, and also addressing the life cycle income problem, which is that people have kids when they're younger. And when you're earlier in your career, that's when you actually are making less money and have less stability and less in the way of benefits and flexibility. So the Family Fun Pack aims to just seal up those gaps so that having kids isn't this extremely stressful financial proposition that puts people into poverty anymore.
Yeah, Rich, it feels like there are some things in here for conservatives to like. I mean, for example, the idea of a child care benefit that has the option of taking that as a stipend for stay-at-home care, or you can take it as professional child care. And then you also have, when Liz describes the mere addition problem there, my understanding is there's evidence that parents are less happy than non-parents, but that more than 100% of that effect is attributable simply to the cost of parenting, that they give up other consumption that they would have. And so if you had policies that tried to level that playing field, basically by giving more money to parents, it would seem that would both make parenting easier and also encourage people to have more children.
Yeah, if you squint just right, you can see kind of a socialist conservative overlap on some of this stuff. You have conservative wonks who've been very focused on coming up with a paid family leave proposal. The conservative objection to a lot of daycare support is that it is biased towards commercial daycare and has a unintended burden on parents who might be taking care of their own kids or relying on informal arrangements. And then there's the child tax credit, which a lot of conservative wonks are very big on promoting. But the goal is the same, to reduce some of the financial stresses around parenthood.
Emily, I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you found about vaccines. And in particular, I feel like conversations here, I mean, it's among people who are all in agreement that the science is clear here and that vaccines do not cause autism and that parents should follow the vaccination schedules that are produced by medical authorities. But how do you reach parents who are not within that conversation? Basically, you have communities where people are skeptical of that evidence. They are skeptical of outside experts. And so beating them over the head with the fact that the outside experts say that they ought to do this doesn't seem to be effective. How do you actually get people to follow recommendations on vaccination?
Yeah, this seems so hard to me. And you know, I had this kind of pipe dream when I wrote this book that I'm going to have this chapter, which is about vaccinations. It really carefully goes through like all of the evidence on, you know, why do we know that vaccines are safe and effective? And it's sort of become clear now to me in my less naive state that actually, like, it is very, very challenging to reach people who are skeptical, because there is always a story for why, well, this could have been made up, or what about this other thing? Or yes, it's true that there's a study of 1 million kids in Denmark that says that there's no link between autism and the MMR vaccine. But, you know, in Denmark, they give the pertussis vaccine at 3 months rather than 2 months. And so how can we really learn from that? And, you know, I think it's very challenging to argue with that kind of logic, because, of course, there's no way you would know that, except that there's no reason to think that that would have anything to do with this either. And so in some sense, I think I am a skeptic of the use of persuasion in this space, beyond the fact that actually a lot of people seem to be persuaded by the existence of measles. And so I think one of the things we've seen in this most recent outbreak is a bunch of people realizing actually there may be some cost to not vaccinating. And it may be that emphasizing those costs is more effective than, you know, revisiting the question of vaccine safety, where we don't seem to be making any progress.
Emily Oster is an economics professor at Brown University, and her new book is called Crib Sheet, A Data-Driven Guide to Better, More Relaxed Parenting from Birth to Preschool. Emily, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Still with me are on the left, Liz Brunig of The Washington Post, and on the right, Rich Lowry of National Review. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters or maybe 280 to distill the spirit of the week. Liz Brunig, what's your Tweet of the Week?
So you're going to have to visualize a little bit to understand mine, but it's from a Fox affiliate named Jonathan Hardison in Birmingham, Alabama. He tweets, new pics of the five-month-old Emma Pine, the St. Clair County baby who's the first confirmed case of measles in Alabama. Heartbreaking to see the effects here, pics courtesy of her mom, Audrey Pine. The pictures show a young baby, too young to be vaccinated, covered with that telltale measles rash.
Rich Lowry, what tweet struck you?
My tweet is from an account called AG Conservative about Marco Rubio responding to Ilhan Omar's argument that U.S. policy bears responsibility for the devastation in Venezuela. And he says Rubio makes an important point in the segment. Until a few months ago, all the sanctions were targeted at specific individuals. Venezuelans have been starving for years. Blaming the U.S. sanctions for the suffering of the Venezuelan people requires incredible ignorance.
My tweet of the week comes from Joe Weisenthal, who's a news anchor at Bloomberg TV. And it's a tweet of a Forbes magazine cover from 2012 that shows Justin Bieber on the cover. And it says, Justin Bieber, venture capitalist. He says, remember when people thought this magazine cover was a sign of the top? That was 7 years ago. No recession since then. We remain in a very long economic expansion. Sometimes people talk about, you know, aren't we due for a recession? Hasn't Donald Trump done things that are likely to cause a recession? Just remember that an expansion can go on for a very long time. Recessions do not come because they are due. And even Justin Bieber investing in venture capital companies is not necessarily a sign of the top. I've been talking with Liz Brunig of The Washington Post and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back with a conversation about economic freedom. How do the left and the right talk about it and fight for it? You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Join the conversation on our Facebook page or tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and other great shows at kcrw.com/podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. Earlier this week, we recorded a special episode of Left, Right, and Center live at the Milken Institute Global Conference. The topic was freedom, what it is, and who's going to protect it best. We came up with the idea for this conversation because of an observation we had. The way politicians talk about freedom has changed in recent years. Compared to most conservative politicians, President Trump places less rhetorical emphasis on freedom and liberty, preferring to talk about strength and greatness. The difference flows through to how he talks about policy. While Republicans used to extol the benefits of markets and say government should not pick winners and losers, Trump prefers to talk about business rather than markets. He's for business and for jobs, but does not emphasize their organic free nature. In fact, he often praises government intervention in corporate behavior that aims to promote business or jobs or strength or greatness. As this has happened, some Democrats have become more eager to talk about freedom. Of course, they're not the first. Franklin Roosevelt had his concept of the four freedoms: freedom from speech, freedom of religion, freedom from want, and freedom from fear. The last two of those represent what you might call positive liberties: freedom not from restriction by government, but freedom made possible by having your material needs met, or freedom that entails another private actor doing or not doing something that relates to you. Conservatives have typically said these things are not properly called freedom. They might be good and desirable, but there's something else. And indeed, policies designed to promote freedom from want may end up reducing other people's liberties, for example, through the imposition of taxes. Rich Lowry was on the right on our panel, along with Kenneth Hirsch, president and CEO of the George W. Bush Presidential Center. On the left, two experienced left, right, and center panelists, Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute, and Gene Sperling, former top economic advisor to Presidents Clinton and Obama. The conversation was wide-ranging, and we talked a lot about the way the right and left have classically defined freedom and how economic freedom can be considered in healthcare policy, school choice, and non-discrimination laws. We recorded the full conversation as a podcast, and you can find that wherever you listen to podcasts. But here's part of the conversation. I started by asking Felicia Wong about President Roosevelt's legacy and impact on one American definition of freedom.
I'm glad you started with FDR. Because I think that it's no accident that in 1941, when President Roosevelt gave his now canonical Four Freedoms speech, he packaged want and fear with speech and worship. And this is for a couple reasons. First of all, in the earlier part of this century, this idea that all of these freedoms were generally part of how we understood freedom, that was just sort of part of the progressive mindset. The idea that there were these negative liberties, of course, there's a long political theory history of that, but like that really became popular in the United States during the Cold War period. So this idea that want, freedom from want, is just part of what real freedom is, that is part of the American tradition. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing about FDR's inclusion of want in a definition of freedom, he was coming, as we all know, out of the Depression experience. He knew what it meant for American politics and American society when you had 25% unemployment. And he very famously said, necessitous men are not free men. He got that. And for him, freedom from want, this kind of floor, was a part of really a plan for stabilizing, in a very common sense way, the guy was pragmatic, the American economy and stabilize American politics.
Ken, why isn't that the right way to think about freedom?
Well, I don't think there's a right or wrong way to think about freedom. I think people have generally a different perspective on how to deliver the key elements of freedom. I think FDR started with worship and freedom of expression, and then he extended it to what an American definition is to include freedom from want. I think freedom is more basic than that. At the Bush Institute, and what President Bush defines as freedom is what's deep in everybody's soul is the desire to be free. And that leads down a path of understanding that if you don't support freedom around the world, then tyranny and extremism can foment. That's not good for anybody. Free countries and free peoples rarely go to war against other free peoples. Now, when you move from basic freedoms to basic services, how we provide basic services, whether it's food and water and healthcare and sanitation, or national defense. Those are things that we as the collective have decided that we're going to agree on how to deliver it. Now we have a really raging debate on how best to deliver it, but I think what I believe true conservative values emanate from basic freedoms of expression, worship, the right to understand and to determine your own fate. And it very, very important, I think that people, and especially the United States, was formed on the notion that we retain our freedoms unless we collectively agree to turn them over to a central authority. We don't say they all belong to the central authority unless they're specifically enumerated back to us. And I think that's more basic than we debate how we provide the goods and services.
Gene, I think sometimes when people on the left think about freedom from want, it can be thought of as emanating from the right to pursue happiness, that basically there's no, you know, you can have this suite of legal rights and negative liberties against government restriction, but if you lack the basic resources in your life to do things, they aren't worth a lot to you. And I guess the question is, how do you define a limiting principle there? Because if you say, you know, well, people are entitled to a basic standard of living, that they are entitled to health care, those sorts of things, and you say these are elements of freedom, you have to say, well, you know, what aspects of healthcare? What is a basic standard of living? Is there a limiting principle to what freedom from want is? Because, I mean, you can't literally free people from ever wanting anything that they don't have. How do you decide what sorts of aspects of a standard of living are an element of freedom and others that are things that can be just left to the market and people may or may not have them?
The reason why I side with the view that FDR first laid out and that Felicia and her organization pursues is that it's not that I believe that the progressive view is all about we're for positive freedoms as opposed to negative freedoms, but asking the question, what does freedom mean in reality to the heart and soul of people as they live their lives? And I've tried to focus some of my work on the notion of economic dignity. There are basic universals that we are capable of providing in terms of the desire to care for your family, to pursue your potential and purpose, to work without a sense of domination and humiliation. And the thing I want to mention is that I think that the view that Felicia and myself and others pursue does have a heavy dosage of negative protections. It's just that when we look at it, we realize it's not just the government. It's also the market, it's also employers, and it takes into account the reality of economic desperation and power imbalances.
Freedom, the classic definition and the correct definition, is absence from coercion. And positive freedom, in the sense we're talking about, especially, you know, protecting someone's dignity, that's a good, it's a benefit. There may be all sorts of policies that we should pursue to improve people's dignity, but it's not freedom, and it's a distortion of the word freedom to define it as such. And the reason why I think negative freedom is so important is, in the broad scheme of things, throughout human history, for millennia, the average person subsisted on less than a dollar a day, unless you're a part of the warrior caste or a priest or the member of royalty, until this concept of freedom took hold. And then you saw this incredible takeoff that has basically created the world that as we know it. Now, I'm not a libertarian. So a libertarian would looks at the state and the individual as the main players and wants the individual to be as free of the state as possible. I'm obviously sympathetic to that, but I think that's an incomplete account. I'm a conservative, and a conservative views one of the benefits of freedom being this enormous substrata of mediating institutions between the state and the individual, family, church, neighborhoods, civic associations, nonprofits, and that those are things that ultimately give our lives meaning and dignity, and they're a function of freedom. And one of the reasons that American civil society throughout our history has been so incredibly robust is because it's been so free. Freedom is dependent on institutional and cultural constraints. It's not anarchy. And you can't have freedom as we understand it and experience it unless you have the rule of law, unless you have social trust. And without those preconditions, you can't have freedom, true freedom.
Let's look to the future. I want to talk about how candidates are talking about freedom in this election and how political actors might talk about it in the future. Felicia, can you talk about, you know, the way Democrats are talking about freedom now, and anyone in the field who you think is doing an especially good job of it?
I think they have a couple people who are really taking this freedom argument to a new level in the current presidential debate. The first and most obvious is Mayor Pete Buttigieg from South Bend, Indiana, who went viral, I don't know, maybe about a month ago, 6 weeks ago, when he gave a speech at a town hall saying, you know, I care about freedom, and I also believe that government is not the only thing that makes me unfree. Very large companies can make me unfree. Racism can make people unfree. So that's one person. The other person I think is really interesting on the freedom point is Senator Elizabeth Warren. Now, some of you might smile.
Why are you looking at me?
I wasn't rolling my eyes. She's made a really interesting point about the ways in which a very cronyist, corrupt government, whether in the United States or abroad, you know, her foreign policy argument is really about a kind of anti-authoritarianism. America should be a beacon of freedom, she argues. That's why government ought not be corrupt. And that's why we have to look at a public service, public interest government that is part of what keeps us free. So it's a very interesting way in which I think Democrats have taken a broad and entirely morally defensible pro-freedom argument in this campaign.
I think one of the other powerful things that's happening on freedom is that you're seeing more, particularly of African American voices in politics, talking about what freedom means. And what's interesting there is that that's not just a call for the affirmative freedoms of government, though it certainly is, but also the negative protections against police brutality, against a discriminatory criminal justice system, against lack of safety in neighborhoods. And so if you want to make freedom real in people's lives, you have to go to where they are and how they experience their freedom. And I think that the advent of police cameras and iPhones, et cetera, have made it a lot clearer to the rest of America how unfree a lot of people in minority communities are.
Ken, does the right have a ready response to the left's case that this agenda they've laid out is a freedom agenda? I mean, I think certainly the word socialism has lost a lot of the sting that it once had for conservatives. Yeah. I think we have a generation that doesn't necessarily associate socialism with unfreedom.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of free in that agenda, the first four letters for particular. I think wrapping ourselves in the flag of freedom, if you will, to include basically an argument that says if we can provide anything, then let's go ahead and do it, is, to me, it's just difficult. But it's the wrong place to put all of the things that Gene was just talking about. We have significant problems in the criminal justice system. We have significant problems in safety on our streets. Let's talk about that. Because that, to me, is those delivering of good, basic goods and services of a developed economy on how we as citizens can do what we want to do more openly and safely and carefully, et cetera.
Rich, it seems to me that part of the shift that we've seen from Donald Trump in the way he talks about freedom has to do with a sense that Republicans were not going to win this argument on a lot of these freedom issues, laying out what they have said previously. Donald Trump, in a lot of ways, ran to the left of Mitt Romney when he ran for president and said, you know, I'm not going to touch Social Security or Medicare or Medicaid. When he talks about wanting to repeal the Affordable Care Act, he talks vaguely about, you know, we're going to have, you know, healthcare for everyone much better and much cheaper. It seems that his view, and I don't think that it was necessarily a wrong view as a matter of political analysis, was that the public does endorse this idea that the government should provide a fairly expansive suite of benefits, and maybe even that is part of freedom.
Yeah, so I would say a couple things. One, I think still, like, if you woke up in the middle of, like, 3 a.m., the average Republican shook him awake and said, you know, what do you stand for? He or she would say freedom. But strength, greatness, winning, hiring the best people. these are the things closer to his core. And I think he did get at a problem with the Republican agenda. One, there's a tendency among some Republicans just to think just saying the word freedom was a substitute to having a well-articulated and thought-out and detailed policy agenda. And two, freedom for a lot of people, it's an abstraction. And then three, I think this is what really Trump gets to. If you take the proverbial, you know, 50-year-old factory worker from a Midwestern town who's lost his job he's had for 20 years, and he's told implicitly or maybe explicitly, hey, look, no problem, you're free to move to North Dakota, you know, where unemployment is 2% and all the fracking jobs are, that's not going to be very appealing to him. And so Trump's put more of an emphasis on security. You see it especially in trade, immigration, and entitlements. Now, I think the most thoughtful and forward-looking conservative policy analysts were kind of focused on this problem, and were thinking through ways to address them thoughtfully in ways that wouldn't increase the coercive powers, the extent of government. But they're minority voices now, and Trump, just through his sheer force of personality, is his approach and his rhetoric are dominant.
That was part of a special Left, Right, and Center episode we recorded live at the Milken Institute's Global Conference in Beverly Hills. You can hear the whole conversation on our podcast feed. But now we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Liz Brunig, what's your rant?
As America's biggest measles outbreak in years wears on and case numbers begin to tally up, it's easy to explain the anti-vaccination problem with very simple terms. It's either the fault of religious fanatics or religion writ large, or ignorance, people who don't know what they're doing. I think that there is some part of each of those explanations that factors in, but I think that it's important to realize that the biggest issue I can see anyway in the anti-vaccination movement is people with just a little bit of knowledge, enough knowledge to be dangerous. These are people who know a little bit about their religions, but not a whole lot, and don't realize, for example, that the Catholic Church is in favor of vaccination and the Orthodox Jewish community has no theological stance against it. Or they're people who hear that there are risks to vaccines, but don't know enough about statistics to actually contextualize those very small risks.
Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
There's often scoffing when conservatives point out that one of the purposes of the Second Amendment is to have an armed citizenry capable of resisting a tyrannical government. This is entirely a theoretical matter in the United States, of course, but in Venezuela, it isn't. The government banned and confiscated guns less than a decade ago, and now faced with a popular revolt that it is struggling to put down by force, it is surely very glad that it did.
For my rant, Steve Moore has followed Herman Cain's lead and withdrawn from consideration to be named from the Federal Reserve Board. Republican senators effectively killed both potential nominations by indicating that they wouldn't vote to confirm them. The Fed Board has 7 seats and only 5 members, but it can work just fine with 5 members, and the Senate has no need to act on President Trump's urging that they put people in those seats that share his views on monetary policy. Similarly, the Fed can ignore the president. The president was out before this week's Fed meeting, calling for a full point interest rate cut and for the Fed to start buying long-term bonds again, like it did during the crisis, in order to push down interest rates and juice the economy. You saw back in December, it looked like the president was exerting control over the Federal Reserve when he was railing against rate hikes, and the Fed actually changed its position and indicated that it would stop raising interest rates. I think we can tell in retrospect that in December, the Fed wasn't reacting to the president. It was reacting to the stock market, which tanked under the impression that the Federal Reserve was about to make big policy mistakes and march ahead with rising interest rates, even if the economy turns south. Now the markets and the Fed are in agreement, and so the president can rant and rave on Twitter and demand interest rate cuts and propose ridiculous people to put on the Fed board, and he can just be ignored. That's all we have time for today. Thanks to Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, Emily Oster, and also to Felicia Wong, Gene Sperling, and Ken Hirsch for joining our panel at the Milken Institute. Thank you to the Milken Institute for hosting us, and special thanks to Conrad Kieschel and Paul von Zielbauer. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Katie Burskins and Colin Cab Washington are our production assistants. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.